They're all incredibly deferential to the United States when the United States threatens its tariffs and says, you know, if you make overtures to China, if you make overtures to Iran, if you try to seek some kind of an agreement with the countries of South America, the United States is going to retaliate. And so countries, European countries, Western countries, Canada, they're really careful about what they do because they don't want to antagonize the United States. So the United States is effectively capable of exerting control over Canadian policy, the policy of Western nations, simply by virtue of its ability to dominate economically and politically.
Well, I think that's about as far as they're going to get, and that will probably cause enough chaos. And we're seeing this already of how this hard diplomacy, what Trump is after, basically comes down to this: to any country he's got in his sights, you'll do what I say, or I'm going to put the hurt on you. And it's usually very clear about acquisition of resources. So, for Canada, if it's oil, if it's energy, it's water; those are the big ones that the U.S. is quite dependent upon. And if there's any sort of deviation from the script, then we can expect Washington to, you know, to say you need to follow this step, you need to do this, or else. It's a sort of hostile bargaining that really hasn't been seen since like the era of gunboat diplomacy. And that's very offsetting for anyone who's been on the planet since 1945. So we're seeing that break in tradition. But in terms of giving up our sovereignty, I don't think we're anywhere near it yet. And you see that in terms of just how our daily lives as Canadians, I'm using very broad strokes here, of course, but the quality of life and the way of life between the two countries is still staggeringly different. I mean, even right down to how our police forces work, right? The what we're seeing out of Minneapolis with the ICE agent right there, there would never, I would like to think there would be so many more, you should never say never, but there should be so many more professional protocols put in place so that situation never would have escalated in the first place. That policing here has a deep commitment to de-escalation, and then sometimes things kick off. The U.S., no, and you see that by the number of gun-related deaths, the amount of police incidents, how tied up the courts are with things like this, and it's an encouragement of that sort of cavalier attitude. It's a country, the U.S., is one, the only G7 country, albeit G20 country, where things like major health indicators were actually decreasing over the past 6 years. So infant mortality, maternal mortality was actually on the increase. And when you look at the spread along racial lines in that country, it's shocking. It's a country where one in two bankruptcies is directly related to healthcare costs. Nobody in Canada can say that. But it's we got a long way to go before we descend into sort of the culture and the way of life that be prescribed in the U.S. And I would think there's enough diversity across this country that to Americanize Canada, that would be a headache beyond anyone's imagination trying to pull
maybe,
over.
Maybe we should make the United States the 11th Canadian province.
At least pieces of it. I think Minnesota needs some help right now. They should come join our team. And while we're at it, let's at least get down to San Francisco on the West Coast.
Robert Hewish, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor. It's been a very enjoyable conversation.
Thanks, David. Really appreciate it.
Robert Hewish is an associate professor in international development studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax. We'll link to Hewish's article, How the U.S. Could In Fact Make Canada an American Territory, at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post a video of our conversation. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Want to get fired from the job you love? Just condemn Israel for the crimes it's been committing against the Palestinian people in occupied Gaza and the Palestinian West Bank. Call Israel a settler colonial state or an apartheid regime. Accuse it of committing genocide. Post your comments on Facebook, X, Instagram, or TikTok. Then, wait a bit. More likely than not, pro-Israeli Zionist forces will complain to the company you work for or the university where you teach, and you'll be out the door. If you're a person of color or a Palestinian or Muslim, you'll be out the door really fast. In the U.S., dozens of university professors have been investigated, suspended, or fired for pro-Palestine speech or activism. It's the new McCarthyism. Those who've held on to their jobs, those who've never said anything at all, feel the chill. Here in Canada, the situation is less extreme, but worrisome nonetheless, especially for those who speak out on social media in the most measured of ways. One university faculty member who's experienced the chill is Mohamed Zuberi. Zuberi is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics and the Faculty of Health Sciences at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. In late 2024, Zuberi was appointed postgraduate medical education director for equity, diversity, and inclusion. Complaints soon rolled in from Zionist forces in both Ontario and the U.S. Judging from the way it handled complaints, McMaster University appears to be an enlightened institution. Zuberi has held on to his job, a job he greatly enjoys. The GPM sat down with Mohamed Zuberi in the studios of 93.3 CFMU-FM. Mohamed Zuberi, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and where you are and what you do and a little bit about yourself.
Of course, yeah. So I'm a developmental behavioral pediatrician, so a physician that primarily works with folks with disabilities, so children, youth, and their families. The main focus of my work is around working with kids that are on the autism spectrum, so autistic youth. So clinically, I do that here in Hamilton, and I'm also an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Faculty of Health Sciences here at McMaster. I've also had the opportunity to serve as the postgraduate medical education director for equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Are you still in that position?
Yes. Yeah, I've had that position since December 2024, so a little over a year.
In spite of all the brouhaha.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Despite all the brouhaha, there's definitely been lots of opportunities in that specific role to really demonstrate my commitment to advancing equity, diversity, and inclusion within the postgraduate medical education space, which is really a space for folks that have finished medical school and are now completing their residency education. So they're in the process of specializing, whether that be in the area of family medicine or other specialty areas like pediatrics. Or surgery, as some examples.
And we'll get back to the fact that you're still in that position in spite of the brouhaha. But a director for postgraduate medical education, director for equity, diversity, and inclusion, what's the position all about?
So it's really about advancing work in the space of ensuring that we create a community of belonging and that we also take into account practices of anti-racism and anti-oppression, which is really mandated as a important strategic pillar within postgraduate medical education. So it's really looking to see, you know, what is the diversity of the folks that are in training? How can we better support those folks, whether that be through mentorship programs, but also thinking a little bit about, you know, how are we selecting? What are our selection processes? How do we ensure that those processes are equitable and ensuring that curriculum and content that is delivered to trainees takes, again, into account an equity, diversity, and inclusion lens, and to ensure that there's alignment between what's happening at the institution level, but also at the program, individual programmatic levels.
Now, you were named to that position. I think you were interviewed in, November of 2024, and you assumed the position in early December 2024, mm-hmm. So a little over a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And shortly after you came into the position, you got an email. And in the email, somebody you knew said, "Are you feeling safe?" Mm-hmm. This was just before Christmas. Tell me about that, because that was the what brought you to realize what had happened. Somebody emails you and says, are you feeling safe? And you go, huh?
Yeah, I was caught a little bit off guard. I don't think I was particularly surprised because I had been doing a fair bit of work in the, you know, sort of space of advocating for humanitarian aid entering into Gaza and really been doing that since October 2023. But it was shortly before the holidays, as you said, in December 2024, I had gone through a full process of applying, being interviewed by a panel, ensuring that I had, you know, prepared for that, and then eventually that position was announced, and shortly thereafter it was brought to my attention that there was a campaign that had been initiated online, and that university had been receiving emails with quite an aggressive and threatening tone. And so I was just being checked in on to ensure that I was safe, and yeah, that's kind of where it all started. It was a little bit surprising, kind of the way that all played out,
and very scary.
It was frightening, partly sort of thinking about myself. I had never, ever sort of gone into the parking at McMaster, which is where I work, and turned to my back to see, am I safe? I had really not asked that question before. And I think for the first time, it sort of came into my consciousness that perhaps this is something for me to think about. And then sort of, what are the implications of that question and sort of what happens next?
Now, what was this complaint about? What were these people complaining about? Who were they? What groups were they? And what was it that... What was their bone of contention?
So from my understanding, and this is publicly available, there were three sets of campaigns that were happening in parallel. One was being led by, again, I don't know the name of this individual, but a MAGA Zionist in the U.S. Who had essentially initiated an email campaign to university leadership. And subsequently, there was also a campaign by the Doctors Against Racism and Anti-Semitism, or the DARA docs, and finally a post that had been made public from Hillel in partnership between Hillel Ontario and Hillel McMaster, essentially saying
that... And Hillel, for those who don't know, is a Jewish students group.
That's my understanding. I have not had any interaction with that particular group previously, nor had anybody ever contacted me directly from that particular organization.
Yeah, Hillel is a very well-established group right around North America, across Canada, with chapters, university campus chapters, Jewish students belong to. Yeah. Well.
And so, I mean, the general gist of the complaints from my read at the time was really that my advocacy for, and what I had been posting publicly around advocating for humanitarian aid within, Gaza, and would ultimately make Jewish learners feel unsafe and Jewish faculty feel unsafe. And as a result of that, there was a request that was put forth that I be removed from this particular position, specifically the equity, diversity, inclusion lead that I mentioned to you a little bit earlier, and that the basis of my work was anti-Semitic, and my advocacy was anti-Semitic by virtue of what I was putting up online.
What you had been saying and had said on social media.
Yeah.
Facebook, Twitter.
Yeah, X, or formerly Twitter, was probably the main space in which I was active.
And what had you said?
It's interesting. I actually went back today, and I went back to 2023, and I looked. I knew what I had said, but I was like, I should go back and look at what I said. And, really the gist of what I was putting out there was advocating with health organizations, including the Canadian Medical Association, Children's Healthcare Canada, the Canadian Pediatric Society, asking that they pressure, and that I also was tweeting at, government officials to say, let's continue to ask for a ceasefire and request for humanitarian aid to enter, because, seeing the death and destruction of children and the emerging disabilities, and was really just from a humanitarian perspective saying, seeing this is hard, and so what's the little role that I can play to advocate that someone puts pressure to help make this stop?
And had you been to Gaza?
I had not been to Gaza, but I had traveled to the West Bank in Jerusalem back in 2011. So that was, almost 15 years ago now.
And had you used the words genocide or apartheid or anything like that? Had you talked about Israel committing genocide in Gaza? Was this part of your discourse?
Yeah, initially when I was advocating specifically around the humanitarian aid, I was very cautious of using the term genocide and was not using that term. You know, subsequently, I've gone on more recently as there's been more evidence that has emerged and we've relied on facts from organizations both within Israel but also more internationally. I have been using the term genocide, but that has probably been more of a recent action on my part.
And of course, listeners may know that the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, the supreme judicial body, is now considering a complaint lodged by South Africa against Israel, claiming that Israel has committed and is committing genocide in Gaza. And the International Court of Justice ruled in August of 2024, I think, that that the argument, the claim that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza is plausible.
No, I was definitely aware of that.
And so this is not totally off the wall for those people who've been perhaps living in a closet for the last couple of years or 3 years, aren't aware that Israel has been accused of committing genocide. So you did put forward that idea that the argument's being made that Israel's committing genocide.
I did, yes.
And this is anti-Semitic, according to Jewish organizations and Zionist types. If you say that Israel is a settler colonial state or is committing the crime of apartheid or genocide, that's anti-Semitic.
Yeah. I mean, that's what was claimed about the work that I was doing at the time. I had a number of folks that are from the Jewish community but, you know, have an anti-Zionist stand, and those folks had actually written to the university in the aftermath of what I was experiencing, really writing in support to say that we've gone through all of your tweets and, you know, sort of one by one, and if we felt that anything that you had said or that, you know, I had said had any ounce of flavor of anti-Semitism, that we wouldn't be writing this letter of support in support of my work.
Independent Jewish Voices Canada.
A number of folks from Independent Jewish Voices Canada had reached out to their networks and had really initiated a letter campaign. I happened to be CC'd on a few of those letters, and so that is where I got the insight that folks were, you know, really coming out in waves to write that nothing that Dr. Zuberi or Muhammad is saying is anti-Semitic. It's really just a critique and a request and a plea for there to be a humanitarian assistance and an end to the death and destruction that was happening and that we've been witnessing.
It's interesting. There is a conflation, some say, I do, between real anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel, the state of Israel or the government of Israel or the policies and practices of Israel. That criticizing those things is not in and of itself anti-Semitic, quote unquote. And there's a conflation going on. It's interesting that Independent Jewish Voices Canada would go through your tweets with a fine-tooth comb and say, is there anything here that's anti-Semitic? And they said, no, there isn't.
Yeah, no, and that was really heartwarming and a validation that really the work that I was doing was certainly not coming from a place of any form of racism or oppression. It was really speaking to, you know, what I've been trained to do as a physician and to be, you know, thinking about health and well-being and advocating for that, not just, you know, in the aftermath of October 2023, but, you know, I've had the opportunity to do humanitarian work well before this in multiple different contexts. I had, you know, volunteered to work with Syrian refugees in Jordan back in 2017. I had done work following the floods in Pakistan in 2010, had worked in Sri Lanka after the tsunami in 2005. And, you know, interestingly, our healthcare institution here at McMaster had actually awarded me the Outstanding Resident of the Year Award back when I was a resident, highlighting some of the work I had done in the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake to fundraise. And so that's been my commitment, and so I didn't see any of my work advocating for humanitarian aid as being any different. But clearly, there was concerns around the conflation, and just as you raise, that I had to then respond to and think about.
And in the end, McMaster University sided with you, if I can put it that way, that you were maintained in your position.
Yes, yeah, I hold my position currently, and I've been chipping away at the asks of that particular position and have definitely had support to continue this work in its current form.
So what did McMaster University, you know, quote-unquote, what did the administration say to you? What did they ask you? How did they deal with this?
Yeah. There's a number of things I can't speak about publicly because I don't have necessarily the consent from folks to be able to talk about it. But I think following the question where we started, which was around, are you feeling safe? McMaster University had connected me to campus security to have a conversation with them. I had also sought out legal counsel just to sort of explore what my options were. And again, to ensure that when I was on campus, that there was sort of a plan in place. And so the campus security was quite helpful in helping to navigate that at the time.
But the university clearly came to the conclusion that there was nothing that you had said, which was anti-Semitic or that threatened anybody.
Yeah, and at no point was there a formal complaint against me within the institution specifically. And I sort of reflect back and think about that, you know, when we're working with facts and sound judgment, that is my understanding as well, is that that's what the university concluded. And so as a result, I continue to be in my position.
And you said that you questioned yourself. I mean, you have questioned yourself, second-guessing what you said, what you might have said, how things you said might have been interpreted, and your démarche on social media, and you've been engaging in a lot of learning and unlearning. Mm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think
like you don't approach social media the way you used to, and I myself, I'm not on Facebook anymore. Yeah. I'm not on Twitter or X anymore. Yeah. I was never on Instagram because I've always found, you know, being the person I am, that I say things like everybody else on social media that I think, oh my God, I can't believe I said that, but I don't take back anything I say. But I realize that when you're on social media, suddenly you're in a whole different cosmos where people say things which they sometimes regret that they've said. But you're now taking a different position. You're following a different course. Your course on social media is a little bit different as a result of all this, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, what I've come to appreciate is that nuance gets lost in social media. And that is probably where most of my learning has been, is that I don't have any regrets about what I've said. I think, you know, when we see a particular injustice, and my, you know, professional and moral obligation is to speak out against it. And so I feel like I've done that from my perspective. But I also now see that there are ongoing opportunities, not just for me to learn and unlearn, but also in the communities in which I exist, whether that's in the clinical space or in the academic space. There's a lot of other work that's happening that I can also help to inform, whether that's, you know, the development of a course on humanitarian crises within the School of Global Health, or organizing rounds, for instance, where we bring in speakers to be able to speak about, you know, what they've witnessed. And that was, again, the other bulk of what I was sharing on social media, was just testimonies from physicians and healthcare providers that were going to Gaza or had been to Gaza recently, to just, again, bring attention and awareness to that. But I do appreciate what you're saying, is that, you know, in the grand scheme, have been more cognizant of what I am writing on social media because of the potential risk of how it may get interpreted and where else I can direct my energies to be able to continue to do this work.
Have you had any conversations with students, postgrads, with whom you interact in the course of your work as the postgrad medical education director for equity, equity, diversity, and inclusion? Have you talked with them about this whole experience? And have you ever had the chance to talk with folks from Hillel, McMaster, about that?
You know, I have not, and certainly in the scope of the role as PGME EDI director, it's not a front facing role where we're directly interacting with residents. It's more sort of policy work and programmatic planning. But certainly, I think the challenge has been is that, you know, folks have found that there's this sort of level of silence at the academy, and so not necessarily having the spaces to be able to discuss this. There's some work that was done at the institution level to organize. I think they had brought some authors, Jewish and Palestinian author. I'm blanking on the name of the book currently, but that had been organized at the McMaster University level. I've not had a direct conversation with Hillel at this point.
It's interesting that McMaster University dealt with this and came to the right conclusion. they made the right decision. They acted in the correct way. We look all around North America at situations where people who are critical of Israel, who are anti-Zionists or staunch Palestine solidarity activists, instructors, teachers, academics, get doxxed and they get fired, and they're in the firing line, and they lose their jobs. This has happened across Canada. It's interesting that here at McMaster, this happened, and you've emerged on the other end. You're still in your position.
Yeah, I think,
I always want to say kudos to McMaster University.
Yeah, and I think, I would echo that in the sense that I think we're still operating in a space where there's a certain level of objectivity that allows us to look at the facts and come to conclusions like the one that you've just highlighted. And as you've said, the reality is that's not the case across other institutions necessarily. And so I recognize that I was still acting in that space where there was a certain level of objectivity on what I was sharing and posting, and based on the facts, and that's really kind of my other learning, is that we want to continue to operate with the facts wherever we can, and not let sort of our emotions overpower those facts, and hopefully that will, always prevail.
Do you feel stronger having emerged from this situation, stronger in your position, wiser in your position?
I think so. I think, it's certainly given me the opportunity to take a step back but also think about, as I was saying earlier, how can I now use this experience as a way to continue to create, positive space and space in which we can support future learners and future trainees to be able to navigate the issues that arise. And that's going to take work. It by no means is something that is happening overnight, but it will take work. So I do feel, more strong, empowered in a positive way.
Mohamed Zuberi, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mohamed Zuberi is a developmental and behavioral pediatrician in Hamilton, Ontario, and an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Faculty of Health Sciences at McMaster University. Since late 2024, Zuberi has served as the postgraduate medical education director for equity, diversity, and inclusion. He is still in that position. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong, and to technical producer, Janelle Litan. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at cfmu.ca and greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Feeders provide hours of entertainment, but you might be surprised to learn that scientists want to know about the species that show up at your humble bird feeder. Consider this. The only way scientists know about those birds is when ordinary people report what they see and hear. When millions of people keep track of their local birds, they help create a detailed picture of bird populations all over the world. eBird, a project of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, lets you log the bird species you observe on a smartphone app or on the web. Whether you're going on a birding trip or enjoying birds near home, you can list the species you found on eBird. Data from eBird has helped guide many conservation efforts, from planning new wind farms away from where eagles fly to guiding habitat protection for declining species. Counting birds, wherever you are, is an easy and fun way to help our feathered friends. BirdNote has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. If BirdNote has inspired you to do anything to help birds thrive, let us know about it at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.